Good afternoon. My name is Edmundo Pasoldan. I'm the chair of the Roman Studies Department, and I'm very excited to introduce you to Martin Caparrós, our professor at large for the next 3 years. He was named professor at large 2019, and because of the pandemic, we took a while to bring him to campus, so I'm very happy that at last Martin is with us. He's going to have lots of activities here. He's doing talks. He's going to have a workshop on Crónica Latinoamericana. He's going to also visit some classes. Long time ago, perhaps too long, I was studying in Buenos Aires when I saw a TV show devoted to books, in which a group of young writers was talking about their just published novels. I was fascinated by the fact that there was a TV show devoted to books in Argentina, and also by the revolutionary ideas of this group of writers. One of them was Martin Caparrós, only 23 at the time. He spoke with genuine conviction, and I was very taken by his delivery. Since then, I have followed his multifaceted career, and I have always been impressed by his energy and by the originality of his ideas in fiction as well as investigative reporting. I have loved his books, some of which are already canonical in Latin American literature. Some of these books about, I don't want to name, he has published 30 books, but some of the books that, for example, just to show you the his range, and about a young Argentine woman anarchist trying to start a revolution in Italy, another book about soccer, books about Latin American identity, about Argentine politics and culture. There he even has a book about immortality, a recent novel. So when Caparrós commits to a project, you know that it will be an ambitious commitment, that he will not leave any stone unturned. If he's going to write about hunger in the world, he will travel everywhere to bring us fresh insights and nuanced reporting. He will be in India, as well as Africa, Buenos Aires, or even Binghamton, right? You were in Binghamton for this book. So he will talk to corporate CEOs about questions of food, but he also will be with trash scavengers in Africa. If he's going to write a novel about Sarmiento, Argentina's most influential president and intellectual, he will go beyond the cultural history we all know and delve into personal and private records that perhaps might illuminate this personality under a new light. If he's going to write his personal history of Latin America, like he did in his recent book, Ñamérica, he will start with the first human beings in the continent, 30,000 years ago. This is Caparrós' approach to writing. Immerse yourself wholeheartedly in your project, so at the end of the day, that what we have is a strange new world, something that has always been there but can be seen now in a fresh light. It is no accident that it is no accident that he is right now writing a book about our present, but from the perspective of a scientist from the future. I'm very excited that the Professor at Large Program Committee has accepted a proposal to make Martin Caparrós a Professor at Large, and I would like to thank the Department of Romance Studies and its main sponsor, as its main sponsor, and the Latin American and Caribbean Studies Program and the Division of Nutritional Sciences as their main co-sponsors. The Professor at Large Program is one of the most intellectually exciting traditions on campus, and I love that a Latin American writer and a member of the World of Romance Studies is part again of this tradition. It hasn't been easy, as I said before, to bring him to campus because of the pandemic. We canceled it twice, his visit. But this is now behind, and we now have him this week with us, where he will be giving talks, visiting classes, and conducting workshops. In closing, I just want to read a brief bio of him for those of you who do not know about him yet. But Martin is a distinguished Argentine author, writer, and narrative journalist, and one of the fundamental Latin American voices of our time. He has elevated the genre of the contemporary chronicle to something that it's perhaps one of the most interesting writing that's happening today in Latin America. In 2017, he was given the prestigious Maria Morse Cabot Award by the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism for outstanding reporting on America. They specify the work on his nonfiction book length work El Hambre, Hunger, The Moral Crisis of Our Time, published 6 years ago. In that book, for that book, Caparrós visits both the richest and poorest people of the earth in order to explore why hunger is one of today's big unresolved issues. He has written more than 30 books, novels, essays, nonfiction, and has been translated to more than 30 languages. His most recent book, Ñamérica, is a complex and fascinating attempt to describe and analyze the present of Latin America. Thanks for being here, and thanks, Martin, for you visiting us.
Okay. No, I'm done.
Your computer is not. No.
Oh, because my notes are in his computer, because my computer is there. So okay. It's a complicated combination. Hi. Hi. First of all, I wanted to apologize for my English, which is usually very mediocre, but it's getting worse and worse because I'm horribly jet lagged. So I haven't learned how to sleep here in Ithaca yet. So. As I said, from mediocrity to disaster, my English has gone all the way. So I hope you will forgive me, or else I can start speaking Spanish, with which the disaster would be complete. It's your choice. Anyway, hi. I wanted to tell you a few things about Ñamérica. This is this last book I published last year in Spanish, and it's going to be published in some other languages in the next years. I usually don't remember how I first imagine a book, but this one I do clearly, which is not very interesting, in fact. I was in a quite boring meeting in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, one of the most complicated countries in Central America, as you know. And there was like a few, maybe a dozen and a half journalists from different countries in Latin America. And they were all discussing about journalism and Latin America and saying, I don't know, things about our region and how it was and stuff like that. And at some point, it was inevitable that I had to say something about it, about Latin America. And I was ready to utter the usual slogans and clichés that I have been uttering for so long. And I don't know why, at that exact moment, I felt like ashamed. I said, I cannot keep repeating the same things once and again. And at that very moment, I said, well, if I spend, I don't know, what time might be necessary, trying to think a few things about Latin America that I could say without shame. I mean, trying to see how it is now, not in our souvenirs, not in our slogans, etc., etc. Was quite a moment, I mean, quite impressive for me. First thing I did when I went back to my hotel room was to get Las Venas Abiertas de América Latina, which is like a classic that most of you have known of, at least, to see if it was reasonable to try to reassess what Latin America was after this book that has like the ambition of doing it and has done it. But it was 50 years ago. And both the continent or the region and the public who could see or read about it had changed a lot, really a lot. So I said, well, there is a reason. It's reasonable to try to work on it. So I started, let's say my plan clearly was, well, what is America, what is Latin America now, right? So I started with my first usual movement in this case, which is to get lost. I cannot stress enough the utility of getting lost, right? When I try to write about the city, for instance, the first thing I usually do is to take different buses, which I don't know where they lead me, and get lost. Spend a day or two going to places that I don't know of, not the places that I have already read about or known about, but to just go to places, I mean, to unknown or unthought of places, okay? And of course, in this case, the equivalent of that, something that I do as much as I can, is to get lost on the net. In the net? On the net? What do you say? On? Okay. Just to let me lead by the chance of the clicks, right? And get to places and to read things and articles and even books or things that I couldn't have looked for before. Okay, so I started doing that, and amongst all the things that I found at the beginning, the one that seemed to me most important and perhaps fertile at the first moment was the evidence of an enormous change that happened in Latin America since Galeano wrote his book 50 years ago. At that moment, it was a rural region. I mean, it was clearly a rural region. More than 50% of the population lived in rural areas, okay? And nowadays, Latin America is, which is not very, it's a bit counterintuitive, but Latin America is the region of the world with the most high proportion of urban population, okay? It's like 81-82%, which means that there has been an enormous change in the structure, the social, cultural, political structure of the continent, right? I mean, one in three Latin Americans has moved from the countryside to these cities in the last 20 or 30 years. It's enormous. It's really enormous. It's a tectonic movement that we are not very much aware of, usually. It's true, to call that cities maybe like an exaggeration. I mean, they have moved to places that became kind of a chaos, disaster, disorganization that are our cities now. But, well, this is what we are. So the first thing I decided to do with this information was to try to visit the cities, okay? And to try to, chronicle them. Is there the verb to chronicle? It exists? To chronicle these cities. I need to say now maybe that lately my method for nonfiction, or my genre, I don't know how do you say, is a mix between chronica and essay, okay? Usually chronicas in Latin America were very narrative, but they didn't dare to analyze or to reflect, to think about the things that they were telling, okay? And a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago, I started to try to mix those two genres, right? The chronicle part and the essay. I used to say that I write crónicas que piensan, ensayos que cuentan. Okay, I don't know if you chronicles that that think, essays that tell, right? To just show this crossing. So I wanted to go to these cities in order to be able to, by one side, write chronicles about them, crónicas about them, but at the same time to be able to see which were the main traits, the main subjects on which I would have to write for the more essay part of the book. Okay, try to get to know which were these common traits that deserve a particular chapter in the book, because the book was going to be like a crossing between these big cities. I mean, the book is done like that. It's one chapter is a big city, one chapter is a matter. It's an issue, okay? well, I'll tell you which ones are in a moment. So I went to 7 or 8 of these cities: Buenos Aires, Caracas, Bogotá, El Alto in Bolivia, Managua, La Habana, Mexico, Miami, maybe some else, but I don't remember exactly. And of course, these are cities of improvisation, chaos, energy, conflict, the cities where the state arrives toujours always far behind the people that formed them, you know, these cities that are established as rings around the old established city, and all these migrants come and form rings around them in neighborhoods where there is no, very often there is no electricity or no running water and no presence of the state. The state comes after sometimes, and sometimes never does, right? And this migration to the cities is a part of a larger wave of migration, right? Which is the one I call the fifth wave. When I started to think about this wave of migration, I had one of the defining traits of New America, of Latin America, that I was looking for. And because now I would like to tell you about 4 or 5 of these defining traits, okay? And the first one, I think, is this. Migration has defined America in a way absolutely, maybe not comparable, how do you say, incomparable with other places. I mean, for starters, now New America is the region of the world with the most high, the higher proportion of migrants per inhabitant, which is strange. I mean, it's strange because New America has been formed by immigrants, right? And now it's the other thing around that happens. But I would like to put this migration within a context of a continent that is pure migration, following a pattern as clear as no other has. I mean, in most places in the world, people has just come in an inordinate manner, right? I don't know, I live in Spain, for instance. In Spain, there was people that came, I don't know, many thousand years ago from Spain, and then some Celtics, and then some Goths, and Romans, and Moors, and Basques, and no one knows exactly when and how it did happen, okay? And this is an example of how populations got got, what do you say, done, okay? Whereas in America, the waves of migration are so clear, it's so ordered, I mean, the way it was, that it's a completely different story. You know, I mean, I'm not gonna tell you that, but there was this first wave, maybe 20,000 years ago, when the Bering Strait was walkable, or how do you say, congelado, iced, or something. And then some people from Central Asia came, and they walked and walked, and they didn't know where they were where they were going. I mean, it's an image that I like, that one. I mean, the fact that people just started to walk, but they didn't know they were going somewhere else. They were just walking, okay? And they came to this continent, which was previously empty of human life, without knowing that they were, of course, they didn't know that they were coming into another continent. And they didn't have the idea of populate a continent. They just came, and maybe someone, and the groups were very tiny, were like, what, 50 people, 100 people at most. And sometimes a group stopped, I don't know, beside a lake because the salmons there were easy to fish. And then maybe two generations or three generations later, someone said, no, I don't want to stay with these people. I think that the deer is easier to hunt in that valley. And it's a very long process because, as you know, afterwards, the Bering Strait just got closed, so no one else could come. And for 15,000 years, these were the only people in the continent. And then came the second wave, the Spanish conquista, of course, which was bloody and horrid. And at the same time, it built the structures we still live in. No? It's funny because now there is a lot of discussion about the conquest. It has come back to public light, mostly because of what the Mexican president say, you know, López Obrador, saying that Spain has to apologize for what they did 500 years ago and stuff like that, which is like a classic story of nationalism, classic tale of nationalism, but not very well crafted. I mean, it's plenty of mistakes, let's say. First mistake is the construction of a pre-Columbine, what do you say, pre-Columbian paradise. I mean, they speak as if the Aztec state was like a heaven of peace when it was exactly the contrary. I mean, they made thousands of human sacrifices, and that's the only reason why 500 hungry Spaniards were able to take this state, because there were so many thousands of locals that wanted to get rid of these tyrants that they supported the Spaniards. Later on, of course, they realized the mistake they had made. But at the moment, it happened because there was absolutely no pre-Columbian paradise, as they want to show us, to convince us now that was, right? And of course, because what happened during the colonial times, it's important for the formation of America. But our states have already lasted 200 years. I mean, in 200 years, we had time to build our own societies, and all the responsibility for anything that could happen in these countries is ours, not Spanish. I mean, it's a classic nationalist tale, the fact that trying to convince everyone that the fault, how do you say, the fault is of goes to the foreigners, right? To others, to the ones that are not us. But anyway, I will go faster through the waves because I wanted to just say it. The third wave is the most violent and vile, right? Africans kidnapped in their places, often by other Africans, to be enslaved and forced to work all their lives for others. It was 16th, 17th century, right? That was the third wave. And these three waves started to form, which is the Latin American population in a bigger, I mean, the mix between these three waves started to constitute what we are. But there was a fourth wave, which is this poor Europeans, Southern Europeans, which arrived in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20s. They were much more geographically limited because they went mostly to the south of the continent, but they were much more than all the other waves put together. I mean, there were several millions when the other ones were a very short number of people. You know that, for instance, in the whole of the 16th century, there were around 100,000 Spaniards that came to America. 100,000 is nothing. And they ruled the continent for a long while. These migrants from the end of the 19th century, the ones that didn't come here to the States and went to the south of the continent, just like finished the mix that constitutes Latin America. And it's strange because usually those mixes are not that precise and clear, right? And nowadays, we can talk about this later, but nowadays we'll talk about this later. the fifth wave, then, is the first that is expelling people, okay? That is the big change in the last decades, is that for the first time, Latin America is not receiving, but expelling, right? There is, of course, this internal wave from countryside to cities, but there is a very huge quantity of people that had left the continent. And to leave your country is a very strong statement about your country, okay? I mean, I can't imagine a stronger one than to say, I can't live like I should in my place, I'm gonna go to some other place in order to try to do it. And it's also the choice of an individual solution over a collective solution. People who migrate are saying, I am not able to solve my problems within my community, I am going to try to solve it somewhere else out of this community. And it's also very heavy loss for the communities that lose them. I mean, usually the people that migrate are, by definition, among the most energetic and proactive people because they take the decision of going somewhere, etc., etc. So this is a heavy loss for their communities to get rid of these people. That's a big wave. That's a big wave. Is the one that explains something that I always find funny. I suppose that you have heard sometimes these Latin American or Spanish politicians that boast about the fact that Spanish is now the second most spoken language in America, right? In the United States. I always say, if I was them, I would try to to, how do you say, to keep it quiet. I mean, try to mantenerlo secreto, no? To make a secret of that. Because the fact that Spanish is the second language in the States is the most visible evidence of this failure, of the fact that so many people had to leave their countries and come here. So if I was one of these politicians from those countries, I would try to, well, better not to say. But they are very, no, they boast. They say, oh. So is that like they are? Anyway, I say that is there any possibility to get some water somewhere? Because there was no. Oh, I'm sorry. Because I'm starting to. Okay. There was I was saying that that López Obrador wasn't that it was not reasonable to fault the Spaniards for what is happening now in America, but it's right that they had like a decisive contribution to what Latin America is now, which was the setting of an economic model, right? The Spaniards, I think, they set the model that is still the most central in our countries, which is to extract and export commodities, I mean minerals or agricultural products or these kind of things, right? From the mines in Potosí, silver mines in Potosí, to nowadays the petrol or copper or soy or coke or coffee or sugar or banana. It's like the same system all around, all through the last 400 or 500 years. And this is really central in the structure of America. Still, it has a decisive influence on the on Latin American social structure. And I wanted to say that because it now comes a second trait that I wanted to consider, a second idea about the region, which is that Latin America is the most unequal region in the world. You have read and heard that many times, and it's true. I mean, it's true according to these coefficients that are supposed to measure that, the Gini coefficient.
Thank you so much.
The Gini coefficient, for instance. Huh? You have heard of Gini? Corrado Gini? It's an incredible story. It has not... no tiene mucho que ver, pero... It's... because he was the statistician, the official statistician of Mussolini, and he was an eugenist, and he was like kind of a fascist, an unbridled fascist. And now it's quoted, his name is quoted by most progressive people deploring inequality. So it's a very strange evolution for his name, but never mind. I said, that Latin America is the most unequal region in the world, and that was one of the chapters that I wanted to work on in America. And I arrived first to a very stupid conclusion, or to a very stupid assumption, which is that America or Latin. I should have to tell you why I call it America, but I told you, I'll tell you later. Latin America or America is unequal because it can. Latin America is desigual porque puede, which sounds pretty stupid, you can say. But I think it's right. I mean, they can, because they are powerful, can afford it. Since the very beginning, I mean, when the economic core of a society is extraction and exportation, you can afford very easily to be unequal, because extraction doesn't need too much labor, okay? And it's a very unsophisticated labor, and it's less and less labor now with the developments and new techniques and stuff like that, right? So the rich Latin American don't need their poor in order to work, because many of them, I mean, it's enough with a small part of them. Do you follow? And at the same time, as they export what they get, they don't need their poor to consume either, because their markets are abroad. So they don't need their poor nor to work, neither to consume. They don't need them. They really don't need them. And that's why they can be so unequal. I mean, when there is another kind of organization, well, the richer need their poor in order maybe to work to produce things and to be able to be prepared to produce some stuff, or to consume in the internal market what they are trying to sell. But if you don't need them, nor for production or extraction, neither for exportation, well, you don't need them. So they just can afford to live in societies where 20-30% of the population are absolutely out of the social structures that were supposed to contain them. People that have no particular jobs, or legal jobs, let's say, that have no access to many of the services that a state should provide, health or education or security or whatever. You know, maybe you have heard this rich Latin Americans, more or less rich Latin Americans, complaining because they have to pay taxes and they don't receive almost anything against those taxes. Now they say, well, yeah, in France they pay lots of taxes, but the education is free and the health is free too, and stuff, da 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 da. And they complain because they don't receive anything from the state against their taxes. Okay? It's very common. Well, they do receive something from the state against their taxes, which is to control these poor that are abandoned because they are not producing, because they are not consuming. So they need the state to in Spanish I call it estados contenedores. Estados que, no se dice, no? You don't say contain, no? That control. And they control through assistentialism, through plants and food sometimes, or stuff like that. That's the usual situation. Or when it doesn't work anymore, then there is repression that comes into the scene, right? That's the use of the states in our countries, which is quite a sad one. But it's without them, this 20, 30, 35% of the population, which is absolutely marginalized, would have destroyed everything many years ago, right? Another trait that we used to accept is that Latin America is the most violent region in the world, right? And that, of course, had to be another chapter in America. So I started to take a closer look to that. And the first thing I saw was very, very surprising, because I realized that if I counted the victims of violence throughout the 20th century, I could say exactly the contrary, that Latin America was the most pacific region of the world. And I'm not joking. I mean, throughout the 20th century in Europe, which is reason and harmony and all these things, there were like 85 million victims of violence, 85 million. In Asia, about 100 million. In Africa, with all these independence wars and civil wars and so, about 15 million. And in America, in the 20th century, there was a bit less than 2 million victims of violence, which is enormous, but is enormously less than in any other part of the world in this period, okay? So it was, again, like counterintuitive, right? One thinks, no, we are very violent, it's a very violent continent. The Latin American dictatorships, in my country, for instance, well, yeah, but in terms of quantity, it was very reduced. I mean, 30,000 desaparecidos in Argentina is maybe, I don't know, one afternoon in Moscow, 1935, or 36, right? Which is a comparison that we shouldn't be doing, but anyway. The fact is, I arrived to that numbers and I was amazed, okay? Weren't we the most violent region in the world? And then I realized that I was talking about, like, let's say, public violence, political violence, right? State violence, state against other state, which is war, or against state against its citizens, which is repression, dictatorship, etc. And that something happened in Latin America in the 90s, 80s, but mostly in the 90s. The big time of privatization all over the continent produced also a privatization of violence, which is a strange phenomenon, but it happened at that time. I mean, a tiny group of entrepreneurs which wanted to do the same thing that all rich Latin Americans have done throughout history, which is to extract and export some primary matters, some commodity, in this case coke from Colombia, realized that to keep on doing business, they had to have some kind of armed structure to go with, because it was a very fought for business, so they had to, okay? And it created like kind of a spiral, you say, spiral of violence that started in Colombia with these private enterprises fueled, let's say, by this violence. And then it went to Mexico, and then to the three northern countries of Central America, as we said, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, okay? So these five countries, and Venezuela for other reasons, have had in the last two or three decades a very huge number of victims of violence, okay? You know that the victims of violence are measured in homicides per 100,000 people per year, right? In Colombia or in Mexico now, it's 25 homicides per 100,000 people per year, whereas the world media average is about 5. Okay, the States is a little bit more than 5. I think it's like 6 or something. But it's true, there are five countries in Latin America that are well above the world average of victims of violence. But the rest, the other 14 countries, let's say, they are not. I mean, they are average. Some ones are a little bit below, some ones are a little on top of it. Which means that, once again, Latin America is not the most violent region in the world. It has some of the most violent countries in the world, which is completely different, right? And there was another trait that I wanted to address. Another one is what I could call the utopian region. No? I think Europeans have been impressing, I don't know, their utopian dreams in Latin America since 1492, right? With some strong moments, well, of course, when Columbus arrived and said, this is a paradise, blah, blah, blah. But other moments in the 18th century with the Jesuits and the Bon Sauvage thing, and in the 19th century with the independences and the surge of pure republics that were not tainted by the monarchies, European monarchies, etc. And of course in the 1960s and 70s with the Cuban Revolution and all these things, right? And this has been like reproduced in the last two decades when there was much talk about like a new Latin American left, or what some people called the pink wave, no? That these governments in a few countries, more than a few countries, in some countries, that were supposed to be left-wing governments, right? I have, since the beginning, I think, strongly contested the idea that they were leftist at all. I didn't believe them, but that's maybe a biographical problem. I mean, in Argentina, the ones that took this stand, the Kirchner couple, they had been neoliberals just 6 years before. So it was hard to believe that all of a sudden they discovered the nationalism and the statism and the revolution and so on and so. But I think that usually some of them, were speaking about being near to the left, close to the left, much more than what they were effectively changing in their countries. But this was like a kind of a feeling, an impression. What amazed me a lot when working for this book was a finding that it's supposed to be objective in the measure of what we can call objective, the figures that some organizations give you, like CEPAL or this kind of Latin American branches of the United Nations and stuff like that. And these figures say that in the good years of the beginning of the century, where there was all this left-wing governments between 2000 and 2015, let's say, the countries with leftist governments didn't, haven't improved the situation of their poor more than the countries with right-wing governments. Okay, the situation of the lower classes in Latin America has improved more or less at the same level, in no matter if the country in which it happened was had a left-wing government or a right-wing government. It was much more driven by the prices of these commodities that our countries exported. And of course, I say, if a government that defines itself as left-wing doesn't raise the situation of their poor more than another one's defined as right-wing, well, that's what does it mean to be left, to be the izquierda, right? I mean, the only definition in which we can agree, I think, easily of what it is to be the izquierda is to better the distribution of wealth, okay? And if you don't do it more than the right-wing governments, it means that that you are not what you pretend to be. That was, for me, a strange finding, because, we usually accept that some of these governments had the... Maybe the Bolivian government was the one who did the most to better the situation of the poor people there. But even though their difference with the raising of the lower classes in Peru is not very strong, you know, and it's strange because Peru was a country where there was a succession of, let's say, right-wing governments in all this period, right? That was another trait that was a surprise, and that's also why I think that the strongest political movement in America right now is a feminist movement, is the one that really got changes, important changes in the last 20 years, which is, we can discuss it, it's almost logic in a time in which we lack of political imagination, right? Feminism does not need to imagine a different order. Basically, it needs to extend the existing order to everyone, which is different from imagining a different order, okay? You don't need to, what feminism does is to include everyone in the order, in the existing order, or something like that, which is absolutely different. Which is absolutely necessary, but it's different. It's something that can be done in a time of no political imagination, which is something I would like to talk about in a minute. I'm almost finishing. Should I finish? Or I don't know the time. I didn't see the time. It's okay?
I think then maybe 5 minutes and it's
okay. Another trait is that it's also, I mean, discussed in the book, is the point of Latin America is now a democratic region, okay? After long moments of its history in which democracy was not very strong there, now most of the countries are clearly democratic, or so we think. The problem is, democracy somehow is becoming a problem. I mean, it's becoming something of a problem. My generation cherishes democracy because we lived through very dark times when we didn't have democracy. We know what it was not to have it, and we somehow fought to get it back, and we respect it, I think, still a lot. But for anyone below 40 years old or something, democracy is just the regime where they have lived all their lives, and it's lives that shouldn't be like they are. I mean, lives that they are not satisfied of, and very logically not satisfied. So they have no particular respect for democracy. It's just that. It's just the regime where they have lived all their unsatisfactory lives, okay? And that reflects in these studies that some organizations do, usually less than half the population of Latin America says that democracy is important for them, and they prove it in any democratic exercise. I mean, for instance, there has been a very important election in Chile, as you know, 2 months ago, and with the most important participation since the beginning or the restarting of democracy in Chile in the last 30 or 40 years, they had 54% of people participating, of participation in the elections, which means that 54%, which means that 45% didn't want to vote, didn't want to vote in an election which was decisive for its country. You could say that it's not strange because the soi-disant model of democracy, United States, never gets to a participation of more than half, right? But when a system it's based on the fact that it represents the majority and it doesn't represent the majority, it's a problem. And I think that in many countries in Latin America, the patience about democracy is wasting, finishing, right? And it's a problem because the alternatives are not very very promising. And well, I don't know what will come of that. The problem, and I try to finish with that, is that, as I said, the alternatives are not clear, are not promising, are not there. There are no alternatives. And this is a trait, a very characteristic trait of this times in Latin America, and I think in the whole of the world. I mean, I think that there are times in history in which societies can build an idea of future that suits them and that gives them enthusiasm and makes them try to fight for it, right? Maybe in the 19th century it was a republic, in the 20th century for many it was socialism. There were ideas of future that were worth fighting for and doing things for. But sometimes in history, there are some moments in history in which societies don't have that idea. Usually because they have already wasted the previous one, right? Or realized it in a wrong way or whatever. And I think that we live in one of those. I mean, we live in one of those moments of history in which we don't know how we would like our future to be. We don't have an idea of how to construct a desirable future. That's why we look at the future not as a promise, but as a threat. I mean, everything we think about our future is a threat. It's ecological threat, demographic threat, political threat, technological. What is going to happen with our jobs? What is going to happen with IA? Everything is a threat, okay? Because we don't have an idea of a desirable future, as I said. And in Latin America particularly, as the situation is tough, it shows, because quite often a country explodes. I mean, there is a situation in which many people in some country feel that they cannot stand it anymore. And then they take to the streets and they demonstrate and fight against the police and so. But all that works according to what I call the logic of la lógica del estallido, the logic of the bang. I don't know how to say it in English. Because all this energy just disperses, doesn't go anywhere because there is no a clear idea of construction. In the same kind of movement, when it has an idea of what future it would like to build, goes in some direction and looks for this advancement. But not having this idea, what we have are these estallidos that pop and just don't produce anything. That's what has been happening in Latin America in the last maybe 10 years. And with the very interesting exception of Chile. I don't know if you can imagine how much it pains me as an Argentinian to say that Chile is an interesting exception. But it is. It's the only estallido that has built up something. And now we have to see, I think that tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, Boric is going to be the new president. And there is something very that I really like about him, which is that he doesn't come as they did, this pink wave governments did. It doesn't come from any of the usual institutions of Latin American politics. Doesn't come from an old party, doesn't come from the army, doesn't come from an old syndicate. So it's absolutely new. It's absolutely new, and at the same time, what he's proposing to do is very mild. I mean, it's not a revolution at all. I mean, if it goes very well, it will put Chile, which is the most privatized country in the continent, at the level of some, I don't know, maybe if it goes very well, could put it at the level of some second-rate welfare European state or something like that. I mean, they privatize the pensions and the education and maybe some parts of the health. That is his ambition, which is enormous, and at the same time, it's not a change of society at all, right? But it's already very much. Anyway, I have spoken a bit too much. Should I read a tiny part of the book, or is it too late? Okay. Dilo, hazte cargo. He says that I ask you to intervene, and then I read, if I can. Okay.
Questions, comments. Many thanks for things. Questions, comments. One question. Yes.
Can you tell us why you call it Ñamérica now?
Yeah, because I didn't say at the beginning, that the book is not about Latin America. The book is about the Spanish-speaking countries of Latin America. Because when I started to work, I found out that Brazil was too different. I mean, it's too big, it's too powerful. And it's really different. It has a different story, history, has different proportions and characteristics. And that very often I had to write things in things like, in Latin America, blah, 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 except for Brazil, that blah, blah, blah. Or whereas in Brazil, tururu. And I said, well, I'm writing two books at the same time. It was like a bit stupid. So I decided to concentrate the book on these Spanish-speaking countries, which have a common history, very important common history, which means, I mean, the common language means history, culture, religion, ways of viewing the world, etc., etc. So I concentrate on those countries, which are we don't think of that because we are used to, but the fact that there are 20 countries in a region that speak the same language is very strange. I mean, it doesn't happen in any other place of the world. I can cite the opposite, countries where 20 languages are spoken. I mean, India, for instance. But 20 countries which spoke the same language, it doesn't exist. So I think it's a curious enough and important enough phenomenon just to take it particularly. But I needed a name, because Latin America, of course, includes Brazil, so I couldn't use it. And I didn't know what to say, because the option, the accepted option, let's say, is Hispano America. But Hispano America, it's a shitty word, really. I mean, I think that I wrote in the book that it's a word that no one has ever said for free. You know, you say it when you're paid for it, when you're a speaker on an official ceremony or whatever, and that no one has ever got up this, a morning feeling so like so hispanoamericano, you know, que hispanoamericano me siento esta mañana. No se le ocurrió a nadie. Entonces I needed another word, and I thought that if the link between these 20 countries was Spanish and the symbol of Spanish is the ñ, well, I wanted to play with this possibility, and that's why Ñ America appeared. Could have been worse, not much worse. But,
okay, thank you.
Just talking about a little bit about Brazil, but also other countries, Latin America, I was wondering, as you said, like the capacity to imagine a different future, well, from Brazil. And I think that today in Brazil, perhaps you could say that a neo-fascist movement represented by the supporters of Jair Bolsonaro are imagining also a future, which is somehow the recover of a past, like a violent past.
The recover?
Of a past, de um passado, more violence. So I was just wondering if other countries in Latin America, we could say that these neo-fascist movements, as in Chile, against Boric, there was a neo-fascist. In Bolivia, they have a lot of big representation. Are they imagining a kind of future that sometimes, I think in Brazil, we are trying to like not allow the laws to be changed. We're not more like Republican perspective to defend what's written in the Constitution. And those movements, they are very strong, with a very strong will to change what the political reality of the country was during the democratic years. If you can call
which
it.
Movements have a very strong will to change and then get
what was Brazil like during the democratic years, since democratization in the 80s?
Si.
What they want to do is to dismantle the laws that were created, the constitution that was created, mm-hmm. and come back with a military dictator. So that there is an imagination of a future that's also the recovery of a past. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if in other parts of Latin America we could say that too, that the political imagination of a radical transformation of the future is now these new far-right movements.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say, because it's true that these kind of movements are arising not only in Latin America, all over, no? I mean, I live in Spain, where this Vox party, which is far right, is getting almost as many votes as the traditional right-wing party, El Partido Popular, which has governed very longly, for a very long time in Spain. and even in Argentina, too, there is a candidate which is someone who just spent his interventions in TV or so, like, how do you say, shouting Bible quotes, ridiculous Bible quotes. First times I heard him, I said, this guy's crazy, he's not going to. And in the last elections in Buenos Aires City, he had 15% of the votes. So there is something there that I I just don't know. I mean, I it's as if the failure also of these, I'd say, fake leftist parties had aroused, had moved the idea of change, as you said, of construction of a different future, to the left, to the far right, but it's just an impression. I mean, I cannot be more specific like that.
So in the beginning you criticized López Obrador,
mm-hmm.
but immediately after you very lucidly
what do you mean?
Immediately after you very lucidly analyzed how colonization imposed an economic model that did influence the inequality in the America,
mm-hmm.
and I think you mentioned this, but later on dictatorships also established an economical way in America. And after the dictatorships, arrangements with the international funds, for example, also determined, imposed, I should say, economical ways in America that came from somewhere else, not by America. So it's not clear to me if you think that only the Americans are to blame, or that there is another that is imposing inequality.
I'm sure I didn't understand the last part of the question. The question.
Yeah, it's unclear to me if you think that only Latin Americans are to blame, or if there is actually an other with some interests that affects economics.
Mm-hmm.
Colonialism in the beginning, and then the U.S. the dictatorships, or with the
no. Well, when I said that that in fact. The basic system of extraction and exportation has been set by the Spaniards 500 years ago, and it's still there. I believe it, but at the same time, we had 200 years to change it. I mean, if we didn't change it, it's not the fault of those who established it 500 years ago. It's already the fault of those who didn't change it in the last 200 years. And I usually don't like this kind of explanations that are too much based on foreign powers. You know, it's easy to say, yeah, it's I don't know, International Monetary Fund or the imperialism, blah blah blah, or doo-doo-doo. Usually, it's local. All these structures, in order to intervene in a country, need a local sector that is much more active and attainable than these foreign, almost abstractions, right? And what I say is, of course, in the last, century, there has been many modifications to this core economic system, but the core is still there, you know? And we are still countries that live from the extraction and exportation, which also changes the way our politics work in that sense that, which is important to attain fortune in our countries, is to have the political power needed to get, to catch these sources of riches, you know? I mean, it's not the classic system of building enterprises, the classic system described by, I don't know, by Marx or any other, which is the original accumulation and the extraction of plusvalía, I don't know how you say, and la acumulación de poder de un sector económico que consigue, gracias a ese poder, obtener poder político. Okay? Esa es la estructura clásica. That's the classic structure. An economic power gets enough economic power, an economic sector gets enough economic power to get political power. And whereas in our countries, it's political power which can get you economic power, because this political power is the possibility of getting your hands on these sources of riches, or minerals, or extensions of land, or whatever, which means that the politics in our countries work in a very different way also, you know, because they have the possibility to conquer still these sources of riches, right? I don't know.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask you if it's possible to connect trade, and mainly ask if we could see this idea of utopia, leaving behind the idea of utopia, leaving behind the idea of utopia,
sí.
This lack of ideals, and this question about democracy and fascism, and if we could turn that into a question, or also a question about which is the right government for the end of times, for the end of the world. Because I feel that is what was there, what you mentioned.
Which is the right government for the end of the world?
Exactly, yeah.
I don't get it.
You spoke about this sensation of growing violence and threat and all these situations that speak about we are close to something terrible happening.
Sí.
And in fact, Brazil's current president, his name is Messiah, mm-hmm. which makes this idea of like how we are thinking within the end of times, in a sense, here. Mm. And this connects with the other question that someone asked over here, mm-hmm. there, how this idea of how the possibility of a future is taken over by the right wing. Discourse on salvation.
I see. I would say I don't know, but I think most something more plain that which is that this constructions. I mean, the construction of an idea of a future takes time. Takes time to. To consolidate, I mean, to mix different ideas, different movements, different wishes that are a bit like everywhere, and at some point they crystallize in a central idea that leads lots of people, and I think that it has been like that at least since the beginning of the modernity, you know, and I think that before also. So I tend to think that this is not different from all those other moments. You know, the big problem of apocalypses is that they never get to realize, and it's because they are clever. I'm thinking these days. I started to think that apocalypses are as clever as how do you say virus, viruses. Yeah, because they know that they cannot kill you. You know, viruses. They know that they can't kill you everybody, because if they kill everybody, they cannot keep on living. And apocalypses do the same. If they kill everybody, they cannot keep living. They need us to be there to keep on imagining new apocalypses. They never realize. So I do think that, but who knows? Okay.
Perhaps I can complement what Federico was saying, thinking about, you know, one of the reasons of the ascendance of the far right has to do with the power today of evangelical churches, religion, especially in Brazil. You see, in Brazil, the mm-hmm. big support for Bolsonaro comes from evangelical churches, and mm-hmm. it's not only, you know, same happening, it started to happen in places like Mexico or Argentina. There are big movements that are not only bent on wanting to, you know, take the presidency, but they have big campaigns against, you know, women's rights, against abortion, mm-hmm. things like that,
mm-hmm.
and they occupy a big space. And religion has always been very important in Latin America, but now with the power of evangelical movements that sometimes imitate evangelical movements in the U.S., or they are very connected to evangelical movements in the U.S., have also very reactionary strength in Latin American society today.
Yeah, well, there is a whole chapter in the book about this religious war that is going on in Latin America now, which is very, very heavy, I mean, because it's a strange and drôle de guerre, already would have said the French, because it's a strange war between two religions that cannot accuse the other one of being unfaithful or heretics or whatever, because they are very close, finally. I mean, they believe in the same God, they have lots of things in common. So it's not your classic religious war, but at the same time, it's absolutely open and merciful, right? And it's quite amazing, because if you see in Latin America until, I don't know, the 70s, the homogeneity of the religious feeling was complete. I mean, in most countries, 90-something percent of the people said they were Catholics. I mean, all of them were Catholics, right? Except maybe in Uruguay or a little bit in Argentina or Chile. The rest of the continent was so monolithically Catholic that it was quite incredible. And the religion has had an enormous role in our history. I mean, it's even hard to imagine established and intervening was for four centuries in our continent, in the lives of everyone. Everything they did was ruled by religion. Everything. I mean, what they had to eat, how they sleep, how they which days they work, which days they don't, how they have to have children, how they have to educate everyone. I mean, everything was ruled by religion that had agents all over. I mean, the priests were all over the place, and they controlled that everyone followed their rules. I mean, it was like a very homogeneous and monolithic ideology that worked for so long. And then now, 30, 40 years ago it started, there are a few countries in which 30%, 40% of the people say they are not Catholic anymore, right? Which is enormous as a lost for the Catholic Church. I even suspect that they had named a Papa Peronista because of that. I mean, because they wanted to make a sign to one of their last strongholds and say, well, we are choosing a pope from your place because you are important to us, right? And they chose this Peronista, which is, it's a whole other story, why it's useful for them to have a Peronista as a papa. But it's a very important, I mean, something that is going to be important in the next few years in Latin America. And the point is that against this theology, this almost, I would say, this teleology that Catholics offer to people, I mean, the salvation in the next world, the heaven, etc., etc. Evangelics offer salvation, offer advantages right here and right now. I mean, what it's a some author called it a theology of prosperity. The fact that they are proposing, I mean, they are saying, well, God is enough powerful to get you a job, to get you the, I don't know, to get your son out of the drugs he's having, or to get anything you need for your life today, not a promise for something that is supposedly going to happen in another world. And that works. It seems that it's working a lot, you know. And of course, the fact that Catholic churches are too related to power, are too stiff, are too their rituals are a bit, I mean, too stiff. Whereas evangelicals are like something that happens, it's alive, right? And it's a big fight. It's gonna define a lot of things in the next years. And nonetheless, because of what you said, because some of these evangelical are allying themselves with the most far right wing governments or parties, right? Quieren que leo o nos vamos? Sí. Ah, se cerró. Es ahora leo. Ay. Okay. I wanted to read it's a bit of the book. A tiny bit. It explains a bit of what it is. And it's a translation to English from Will van der Heijden that I hope will translate the whole book, okay? It's something we should be and never happens. We are our own failure of ourselves. It often seems that being Latin America is a should be that never comes into being. It's a deception. It never happens. And we bemoan it a lot, as if it were an error committed by someone or something. We believe in that integrated should be and are surprised when faced with the disintegrated actuality of being. We deem ourselves a perpetual failure because we are not what we should be, instead of accepting that this is what we are. We don't stop to think, for example, that we've now spent two centuries stubbornly persisting in the work of our own disintegration, a point of absolute pride for us. Through the last two centuries, the intrepid endeavor of our nations, our intellectuals, our populations, and our executioners consisted of seeking out and or creating differences between territories and peoples among whom those differences weren't all that clear, and making America, dividing it into nations. Inventing nations is, first and foremost, establishing differences between lands that were one and the same. Convincing ourselves that an Argentine from Corrientes who speaks Guarani is something radically distinct from a Paraguayan who speaks Guarani and lives on the opposite side of the river, and that one should even go to war with the other when there are wars, or remember them and sing about them when there are not. And that a Peruvian who speaks Quechua on one shore of Lake Titicaca is the enemy of a Bolivian who speaks Quechua on the other side. And that Colombian who speaks the best Spanish in Cúcuta should fight against and reject a Venezuelan who speaks so similarly across the bridge in San Antonio. And on like that throughout the continent. Nations, the great modern myth, their borders. There were times, so many, when borders didn't exist because countries didn't exist. Lines were blurred, Spaces were confused. Territories were mixed. The border was one more thing that was sold to us as eternal, natural, as if there couldn't be a world without borders. That is false. It's how most of Earth was for most of history. Something very similar happens with countries. Common sense pretends that they are immutable entities. The nation is, before anything, after all, eternal. And yet, 2 centuries ago, our nations didn't exist, and there's no guarantee, absolutely no guarantee, fortunately no guarantee, that they will still exist in another 2. Countries are very complex, very fragile pacts that tend to be made and unmade, and that, to exist while they exist, need to convince you that they always existed, that they are not temporary but permanent, that some gods or fate or who knows what all-powerful entity has breathed an immortal essence into them. The construction of differences. There were no countries per se, no kingdoms per se, no nothing per se. There were no prior legitimacies because independence consisted of removing them. Everything was yet to be built. That's why it was so important to create countries, to create differences with the rest of the territory, stories that would justify the fact that up to this point, the power is ours. It is quite an original process, the invention of nations in a place where there were no clear reasons, where the language was the same, the religion was the same, the government was not. Some people like that there are nations. Others of us like it less, but that's not the point for now. Like it or not, the truth is that nations exist, and that any idea of Latin America must consider that partition, those differences so laboriously constructed. Our great achievement was convincing ourselves that nations are unto themselves, natural, real, when really they are, like most everything, a matter of discourse. For 200 years, we've been trying so patriotically to prevent that Latin American unity from coming into existence, but then we bemoan its absence. But it's precisely this shared past and the relative youth of our nations that allows us to think of Latin America as if it did exist. There's no other continent that continues living the effects of a common past like this one, which still shares so many traits. The regions into which we tend to divide the world tend to be assembled according to physical proximity. We think of Europe and we group Italy and Norway, Romania and Germany, Russia and Portugal together in one concept. They are unified by the fact that they are delimited by same oceans and, just in case, by various forms of the cross. Far more differentiates them. Whereas here, we are talking about units that, before being founded, were shaped by the same language, the same religion, same culture, the same population, and similar stories. That creates the illusion of a possible unified whole, and every so often, the need to understand what we are if we think of ourselves as one. Which doesn't mean that Latin America is a future should be. Latin America isn't an instruction. It's an historical reality worth unpacking, understanding. Let's consider the metaphor of the choir. A choir is a gathering of voices that become one voice. In other words, the question, what is Latin America? What is it to be Latin American? It seems a silly question, but I've learned to respect silly questions above all others. I think that when you reach the silly question, it's because you're beginning to approach with the matter, to get close to the nucleus. And then that apparently silly question winds up central. Everything consists then in knowing what it would be to be Latin American. In other words, what, beyond nations, those laboriously constructed differences, make us kindred, unites us, brings us together. To put it bluntly, what the hell do we have in common? And that's what the book tries to answer to.